Well, hello and welcome to an all new writer's block. It's Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's dark out and it's not cold. It's an unusually hot November. I guess Greta might have been right. You know, she's right. Never burn the coal. And with me here tonight, I have the indomitable, the baldest, the steel-headed, Mr. Goad, the baldest hate monger on the planet.
Was that, that was baldest, baldest and boldest, yes?
Yes, bald, both of those, okay. I would say. And he, as he has been telling me, he is a convicted felon.
I can't help but bring it up. We were talking about voting, yeah, that I'm allowed to, but I don't anyway.
Yeah, well, it's one of those privileges you wish you did not have. It's one of those ways in which the system just gives you these insignificant, humiliating rights so you may exercise.
I think it's riot insurance. The only two things I ever voted for that passed were, it was when I was in California, it was a ballot initiative to roll back car insurance by 20%. It passed, and I felt like part of something. I felt like my voice mattered. And within 3 months, I was paying double the car insurance. They found a loophole, and that was like 1988, I believe. And then I voted for Trump and got nothing that I wanted. So you do kind of, it's, there's a learned helplessness with me as far as voting goes.
Well, that's interesting. I would love to, you're tempting me here, Jim. I want to discuss car insurance all night long. It's because it's, it's exactly what I did before becoming a professional racist internet show host. But we have more important things to discuss. Now, as regular viewers will know, every, well, let's call it end of the month, we have a month in review type show here on the Writer's Block where we take the most influential, the most interesting, the most popular, the most articles from Countercurrents and discuss them with a respected writer of the Countercurrents stable. And it is a genuine writer's block in the sense that we are a blockage in your sink. We are made of writers and nothing's going to go down without our say-so. And I may be mixing metaphors here. It's the ESL kicking in, you could say. We are also open for your donations. You can pose us questions to us. You can even insult us. I hear Mr. Goad likes being reminded that part of his head is not organic matter. So feel free to welcome that. And as he has pledged, I call you steel-headed, but you're actually harder than steel. Leni von Riefenstahl, she spoke of the heart like Krupp steel. Well, Mr. Goad, he has a head like a titanium battering ram. When the inevitable happens and the great conflict arises, we will use them to break down the doors of our enemy's stronghold, inshallah. And That is what I have to say about that.
It was so cement, even before brain surgery, but now I have literal titanium in half of my skull. So yeah, it's a tremendous advantage in a fight. Not being very quick or coordinated, it definitely helps.
Yeah. Well, this I have actually done that even in an unaugmented skull. If you bow your head into the opponent's punch and it lands right in this area here.
Break your hand.
Yeah, it could break their hand. Even if it doesn't, it hurts like hell for them, for you as well, because it is your head, but no permanent damage. This area here, I've used it to break down doors, and it's very effective, better than my knees. Your knees are very fragile. Do not use your knees to break down doors or to hit other people in their knees. That's a little fighter
experience. Just about anywhere else, though, is good. I mean, that's what Muay Thai, isn't it? Eight weapons, the knees and the elbows instead of the hands and feet.
Well, personally, I learned it was called Krav Maga. It's like Muay Thai for Jews.
That's Jiu-Jitsu, right?
Exactly. Jiu Karate, as they like to call it. It's really the fine art of kicking people in the groin. But
eye gouges. Stung. It's like the dirtiest martial art. Everyone I know who's ever practiced, they throw up. They just work you to death.
And it's eye gouges. There's only, I was only really taught of one situation where an eye gouge is appropriate. Because whenever you position your fingers in for an eye gouge, you are leaving them open to, well, fractures. Because, you know, you're trying to poke someone in the eye. There is a move for point, but if you miss, you hit the forehead, which is very hard. And And as the writer's block logistics team has just informed us, well, we are drinking tonight Alaska Chaga tea. Alaska Chaga, they are great friends of the show. And indeed, I see Mr. Alaska Chaga himself dropping a Ninjagini in the chat to show his support. And of course, this is a fine beverage, and I recommend everyone listening get some of this.
It's some form of therapeutic mushroom, I understand.
Yes, it's a very therapeutic mushroom. It you could say it broadens my horizons.
Great.
Helps sleeping too, good with antioxidants and everything. Nice. It's a fine, fine product. And of course, Alaska Chaga soap. Never leave the bathroom without it, I could say. And wow, the donations are pouring in. The viewers are pouring in for Mr. Go. You are a popular fellow.
I'll sing, you know, You'll Never Walk Alone, Jerry Lewis telethon songs, whatever it takes to put us over the edge here to the 200K.
Right. Excellent. Now, speaking of singing, I was going to keep this in the wings.
Yeah.
But Mr. Goat has brought it on himself, you could say. I was going to spring the humiliation on him, but we have people, we have our indomitable and heroic moderators, Gadius Maximus and Bartleby, throwing at Countercurrents a combined $120 American, I might add. And they say a C note, and I guess the 20s for me, from the Janny crew for Jim to hit all the right notes to I've Always Been Crazy. And I'm told that song holds special significance for Mr. Goad.
It actually, I mean, that's a Waylon Jennings song. I can't do it off the top of my head. I will record it because they've donated that. But the girl I went to prison over always used that in her email handle. Always Been Crazy at hotmail@usa.net. Yeah. Mm. And last I heard of her about 10 years ago, she was harassing someone who gave a positive book review, but using it was clear it was her just from the psychotic threats, but Always Been Crazy was the okay. Waylon Jennings. It's Waylon's outlaw phase. I'm more fond of his greaser phase, like in the 60s, but I'll do it. It'll be on, you can look up karaoke, Jim Goes Karaoke Cavalcade on YouTube. I do karaoke requests there.
Excellent. And just pencil that into your day book, your calendar, Mr. Goad.
Always been.
And for anyone who may be wondering, Mr. Goad will sing for you. He's available for racist shows. He's available for weddings, funerals, and bar mitzvahs. Personally, I was planning my funeral because I'm a morbid motherfucker, and I was thinking maybe I can work in Jim Goad singing "Toxic Love" in there somewhere. You know, the number from Fern Gully, the ecological propaganda.
I do not. I'm sure I can learn it. I'm actually an ordained minister.
Boiling grime, acid rain, pouring down like egg chow mein. It's done by Tim Curry, who's not a criminal against music, unlike myself. So you listen to that. And when I die, if I predecease Mr. Goad, which I should be so lucky,
he's gonna sing. There's not much to look forward to.
Right. Okay, I think that's all of the panhandling, all of the dancing bear self-humiliation and crass financial concerns out of the way. Reminder, people, we would like you to donate to Countercurrents through Entropy. That's Entropy .live/Countercurrents. And if our moderators would be kind enough to drop that link into the DLive and Odyssey chat so people can more easily access it and give us that sweet, sweet money. So I think we can actually start getting into the meat of the matter. The meat being, let's start with, since I brought up Tim Curry.
Yes.
Let's start with Mr. Edmund Connolly's Rocky Horror Picture Show as a Morality Tale, a review of the 1975 film, musical film, I would add, starring Tim Curry and I hear Susan Sarandon before she got all saggy and ugly. Now, Jim, you had the opportunity to read the review,
yes.
But I gotta ask you, you were kicking around in 1975.
Oh, sure.
What was the impact of the Rocky Horror Picture Show on the culture.
I remember being a block away from Philadelphia City Hall and seeing an ad for it, and I just knew that this was some kind of outcropping of the glam rock because it had that androgynous thing just on the poster. But I went to see it once with some theater people because I wanted to be an actor when I was a teenager, and they did all the throwing of the rice and all that. But I was kind of surprised. The takeaway from this article is that it's a reactionary morality tale because they have fun and then they get punished for it. Am I misreading that? Yeah, okay. To fill in the gaps, please. I've seen it once. I didn't need to see it again. I'm maybe it's just raging autism, but I see fewer movies than just about anyone. And I think it's I know people who've devoted their life to sitting in front of a TV and are out of shape and non-functional because of it. So I think if anything, movies should reflect life, but a lot of people I think live through movies, so that's my whole I did that article was a Life the Movie about the young Negro buck in Northern California who he got into a domestic dispute and he had a giant hunting knife, and the cops got him to put the knife down temporarily, but he thought he was in the Matrix. He thought he was in the movie. And I remember when the George Floyd riots were popping off, I thought that Antifa, they all thought they were in a Star Wars film, and all the black kids thought they were in Grand Theft Auto. I think there's one of my whole generational beefs about the youngins is they can't seem to distinguish between virtual reality and, you know, tangible reality. But regarding the Rocky Horror, yeah, that's what I took away, was that it was reactionary because they both got seduced by the Tim Curry character. But at the end, you know, there was pain. And that's reactionary morality. Where did I get that wrong?
Well, that's there is that ending. The ending shot, I think, makes or breaks the film. I was watching rewatching the ending shot, just specifically preparing for tonight. And after reading that review, which is linked in the article, and if again our heroic and indomitable moderators would just post the link to the Edmund Connolly article in the DLive and Odyssey chat, I think that the image of Brad and Susan Sarandon woman, I forget the name of the character,
Janet,
crawling in torn bodices, ripped bodices, just these wretched, miserable things crawling in the dirt, in the mud, around their crippled professor, who's also, you know, being humbled and humiliated, you could say, by Frankenfurter, by the Tim Curry character, really makes it that basically, as someone who has had problems with substances in the past, as someone who has spent some time wallowing in his own bodily fluids, and the less said about that moment, the better, I really could connect to that. You know, someone who had to be picked up by family members up from the floors of various bars and police stations. It's not a good look on people. It's not a good look it really shows that basically you can have your fun. It's going to be very entertaining. It's going to be far more entertaining than anything you can do living the quote-unquote trad life, maybe. But the price for it, it's not so much physical. You know, we all know the physical price of addiction and of promiscuity and whatever. The price to your dignity is so much higher, because when you become known as the guy who does drugs, or as the whore, the woman who is a whore, who will just open her legs for whatever, it's I think the humiliation of that is very well portrayed in the film. Just these two wretched figures crawling in the dirt. And I'm reminded of this apocalyptic painting by, I forget who it was, when this insectoid humanoid thing is just crawling in the mud in the shadow of a great industrial, whatever the hell it is. It's one of those things that is used to depict what life's going to look like after the pod if our enemies win with the Great Reset agenda, I think. But it reminded me of that. I maybe should have looked that painting up. It's one of the most disturbing images we have.
I'm unexpectedly and surprisingly prudish about addiction. I mean, I've written a lot about drugs. I stopped drinking when I was 20 because I'd been in police stations way too much by that point. I've tried just about every drug I ever had the opportunity to do. Only had a habit with marijuana, and I recently kicked that. I tried to moderate it. I just never could. If it was in front of me, I'd do all I could. But grew up with an alcoholic father where, and you talk about dignity, where you come home from school and you have to step over him because he's passed out, you know. And you have these people, well, we should let all the addicts out of prison. As someone who's been violent and someone who's done intoxicants and someone who's experienced the end of that from other people, I think addiction causes more systemic human suffering than, unless you're mutilating, you're crippling someone with the violence. I had a violent childhood with the hands of an alcoholic dad. I would have taken the violence over the alcoholism. Mm. As far as whores go, though,
don't they go hand in hand usually?
From what I know, at least in America, 40% of violent crimes are alcohol related. So yeah, I've been around drugs. I've never seen people act as stupid or as violent on anything as they do on drugs.
Yeah, we know from psychological research that only two drugs really increase your aggression. It's one drug. It's alcohol. There is some indication about cocaine, but what cocaine appears to do is make already violent people more violent. You can't take a peaceful guy, dope him up full of cocaine and make him violent. You know, it takes alcohol.
I think of all kinds. I think meth, Adderall would probably, if you're predisposed. Yeah, I'm too tweaked just naturally, so I stay away from those.
Right. And about the whore thing were saying.
About whores. I did an article called The Slut Reconsidered because I don't have this, what's known as Madonna whore thing in my mind. I've known lots of sluts, consorted with sluts. There are two kinds. There are women who just like sex and are good at it. They don't seem to have personality problems. It's the women who are looking for something besides sex and use that, who have a hole, they've got the hole down there, but they've got a hole inside themselves that they're trying to fill. That's where it becomes a problem. Where if a woman who has meaningless sex, I think, is much less messed up than a woman who attaches an inordinate amount of meaning to sex. That's been my observation, at least.
Well, that's
not a popular opinion, I'm sure.
I think I'm not qualified to answer that. I will say that in my experience, now the crazy slutty ones are the ones who, for whom sex is not an end but a means.
Right.
That. Sexual insanity in a woman or sexual maladjustment in a woman is usually about not the sex,
right,
but something else besides. What that something else is varies from woman to woman. You
dad.
Can go with the
one word, three letters, dad.
Right.
Almost always. Yeah.
Right. It's really more about what dad did not provide or what dad provided too much of, and there you get the nuance.
Right. Yeah,
but it stems from dad every time. You're right there on that count, and that's the take on Rocky Horror Picture Show as a morality tale. Now you said you saw it with artsy fartsy people. What were the reactions at the time?
Just this was back when this was transgressive. It wasn't like you don't have 4-star generals who are Frankenfurter. It was different. It's funny. I mean, I guess, I think going to Catholic school, I'm really attuned to taboos and I have radar for it. This was outrageous in 1975, but it's mainstream now. Mm. Were there any racial stereotypes in that movie? I don't think so. I think it was an all white cast. That's probably what it would get slammed for now.
Yeah. People would complain that transgenderism is too white.
The magenta girl I thought was hot, and Susan Sarandon, you talk about before she was spoiled. When I was on Frody's Decameron Festival, mm-hmm. I did a 1970 movie called Joe with Peter Boyle, where he's this working class guy, works in some kind of steel mill and goes out and kills hippies. Mm-hmm. That's her first starring role in a movie, and she's topless within the first like 5 minutes. And this is 5 years before Rocky Horror. So gravity, like nothing has affected her with those sunken puppy eyes. Very nice.
I loved Susan Sarandon ever since I saw her in Thelma and Louise. And maybe that makes me a weirdo, but it's still one of my favorite films. You know, and I just love the way she says.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I'm in deep shit, Jimmy. Deep shit, Arkansas. It's one of it's one of the things I use in my daily. It's like, normally I speak Macedonian, but I will break into English just for that line. It's very witty, I would say.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess there's something wrong with my head, but I love Thelma. Thelma, I just can't help myself, Thelma. Wow. I just love Thelma and Louise.
And Gina Davis is the other one in that, right?
Yeah. Just grab my hand. We can drive over this cliff together. Anyways.
I have to recommend, as far as like an even younger Gina Davis, you can look up Buffalo Bill Dabney Coleman. If you just look up Buffalo Bill, you're going to get something else. But on YouTube, Buffalo Bill Dabney Coleman, he was a comic actor. He was the asshole boss in 9 to 5. He did a sitcom, which was hilarious and unheralded in the early 80s. You have a Gina Davis who's like 22 in that. Amazing. Mm. And she's apparently some kind of genius. Mm. Like these hot girls. Jane Mansfield allegedly had an IQ of 165. I find that hard to believe, but maybe they mistook chest size for IQ. But
anyway. I would listen to what's her, Gina Davis, rattle off integral calculus for hours. I would. I like the way they get her all ripped bodies, like in a dress which resembles a wedding dress in the rape scene in Thelma and Louise. It's like really she's getting initiated into the sisterhood of man hating, as along with her friend Thelma. And what's the cowboy's name who tries to rape her, you know? And it's like, I forget his name. Anyways, it's really symbolic.
Reluctantly, but... One thing I noticed too is, I mean, I have trouble watching any movie made after 75, and I'll usually watch old black and white films or silent films, but there's a rape scene in every movie back then. Like even in comedies, Harpo's like humping the leg of every woman he runs across. It was just mainstream. It's great. Like you're talking about normalized. That was an actual rape culture. It was expected.
I think it was trying to astroturf the prevalence of rape to give credence to feminist hysteria. I see the thing is, if you remove blacks and you remove a lot of the other problematic ethnicities, there's just not enough rape to justify feminist hysteria. You know, maybe there is some unconsensual coercion, and it mostly comes from Jews. And which explains maybe why feminism is so Jewish. It's just Jewish women trying to run and cover from these poivites they got running around. And who knows? We were talking about Susan Sarandon's tits, and they're on display in that really cheesy vampire movie where she's a vampire, lesbian vampire.
Oh, with David Bowie's
in it. Yeah, I forget the name.
The Hunger.
The Hunger. And they got that lesbian sex scene with the lovely song. It's I saw that in a hipster cinema house, and I was like, but this was 2014, 15. We were all jaded. And I'm thinking, imagine seeing this in the 80s, and imagine seeing basically the softcore porn flick, you know, in the cinema, and being told this is great art. And it is great art. It's a good film. You know, it's a little cheesy, but it's a good film. And David Bowie is fantastic in it. Very underrated as an actor, Mr. Bowie.
I think I've seen him in one movie, the one where Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, where he's a Japanese POW camp. But I fell asleep during it, so I can't really rate it. But
Singers as actors. I think the greatest surprise came from Sting in the David Lynch Dune as Federata Harkonnen. You know, you don't expect someone like Sting to be able to pull a role like that off, but he does.
To lapse into Uyghur speak, I mean, I give props. I was surprised. I never thought Tupac Shakur was anything as an MC. He was in that dumb John Singleton movie with Janet Jackson. I thought he was a really good actor. The worst musician becoming an actor I've ever seen is the guy from Bruce Springsteen's band in The Sopranos. He's so bad, I think he almost destroys The Sopranos. The acting's fantastic in it, but he's just mooking it up, and his acting's as bad as the toupee he wears. I know people like her startup, but I think he's just awful. Silvio, I think, in The Sopranos.
Yeah, Silvio. I'm just trying to process this. You don't like Silvio. Okay. I liked him as a character.
Paulie Walnuts and Phil Leotardo are exactly like the Italian dads that I grew up. Those guys just rang true for me. He's just mucking it up like he's mugging
it up. I've met a guy who's just like Paulie Walnuts on Sicily, on the Isle of Sicily. I've never been to America, but, you know, I met a guy who's almost exactly like him in body language. Didn't even look like Paulie Walnuts, but didn't speak like him, obviously. But just the way he does the finger thing. Hold up. You know, you all these tiny little things that actually make a character. Maybe that was the point. Get this plank of wood for James Gandolfini to act against. So I don't know. Who knows? That's why he has so few lines, I guess. He always struck me as there is a psychotic charm to Silvio because he's such a fake, contrived person. You think this guy's the craziest of them all, and it gets, you know, lost in the sixth season where it turns out he's a big pussycat. There's nothing under that tough exterior, and now you've actually broken the spell for me. Now the tough exterior is just this guy doesn't know how to act.
That's all I got. Phil to me was the most realistic killer. The scene where they murder, I forget what his name was, but the fat gay one,
the Fanuc, right?
The Fanuc. Vito. Yeah. He was like, ice in his veins during that scene. But so much like that. I mean, I grew up basically around the cast of the Jersey Shore in suburban Philly, like the Scattereggias and the Scaramouzas and the Rocco and Gino Varicali. It was 50% Irish, 50% Italian, nobody else. But like, those are the characters that rang true for me. I can't bring myself to, I mean, I only watched it because I was shacked up with some, she was the daughter of the wealthiest Jewish pimp on the West Coast. She looked like a miniature Fran Drescher from The Nanny. And all she did was smoke cigarettes and drink beer in bed and watch TV. So that's when I watched all The Sopranos.
Did she make Fran Drescher noises at least?
Yeah. Yeah. She had her uses, but she was a completely non-functional person otherwise. But that's, you know, but I mean, prequels and sequels, that's when I kind of bowed out of movies was, and again, I'm 60. So I was like, I was 14 in 1975. And when they started putting, you know, Roman numerals after movie names, I just, as a young sapling, I'm like, that's unoriginal. That's creative death. So I can't get into remakes and sequels and prequels and what the first Star Wars is now the fourth Star Wars. No, it gives me a headache.
Too much mathematics for the Irish, as usual.
I mean, you bring that up. I did better in my SATs on math than verbal, and I really regret not taking that route because I really regret using becoming a writer because I feel that it's futile at this point.
Well, and mathematics would have been just as futile. Now, a lot of people are not going to believe that, but I also tested higher on mathematics than on verbal. Did not do the SAT. I did a different test, and I was Macedonia's. I wasn't the champion. I was second after the champion, Republic champion in mathematics.
Nice.
At the high school level before I went to law school because my family is a family of lawyers. So did I make a mistake? No. Maybe I should have gone on to do physics, biology, architecture. I always loved these things. But I'm thinking if I had been an architect, they would have shoved me somewhere, making these projects of doing basically the work of a construction foreman rather than of a true architect, you know,
and well, there's something making eternal these about
bullshit houses, you know. So it would have been even more futile than what I'm doing right now.
I wouldn't be killing myself working 7 days a week, but it was based on the dumb premise that people are honest and susceptible to logic and well-reasoned arguments. And it took me a long time to realize that is simply not true. And the world has gotten dumber. It just, it feels like, yeah, waste of time. But that's my own problem.
Yeah. It is definitely, it does sometimes feel like banging your head against a wall without the aid of a titanium plate. You know, but one of these days, this wall is going to give, because you know what, a lot of those Nordicist types, they're very delicate, their foreheads are very high up there. But you and me, Jim, you know, Irish, Macedonian, we don't give up so easily, and our heads are better used smashing rocks than for thinking.
I'm not sure how obvious it is, but this is a giant head too. It's like a size 8 hat. And even when I played Little League, I had to wear the coach's baseball cap. Just monster head. Looked like Charlie Brown as a kid.
Well, it just goes to show you're just a big smart fellow. And it is a phenomenon we observe. I have a big head too. It's Mrs. Jilby also has a big head. So when our children come, you know, they're probably going to be giants in the head department.
Cesarean, perhaps.
We know people who did the cesarean thing, and it's dangerous. You know, God meant for children to come out of down there, so that's where they're going to come from, unless they're, you know, feet first or something crazy like that. Always choose the natural birth. I hear, you know, we're complaining about modernity. I hear women are electing to give birth by cesarean because they know they don't want to be in pain. Well, cesareans are surgery, and they're dangerous, and they can leave you crippled.
I was, as I usually do, I was thinking more selfishly. I was thinking as far as male pleasure goes, but that's a completely different topic. I guess they have episiotomies and things such as that. I mean, I dated a girl who had 4 kids, and it was, you know, whistling in the graveyard pretty much.
Hmm. I had not considered that possibility. Well, there's always, you know, you can always get a mistress. I think we can move on. I think we have exhausted the subject of the Rocky Horror Picture Show as a morality tale. Now, we have entropy questions. Jim, you're going to have to answer a question which has been long in the works, just got lost in the mail, I guess. There is a question from Niels Ebbesen. For $50 American, a gentle reminder to ask the venerable Jim Goad about the differences between hillbillies and rednecks. Take it away, sir.
Actually, Greg forwarded me that question via email, and it's basically one of locale. Now, the etymology of redneck is more disputed than hillbilly, but hillbilly is pretty obvious. These were in America, at least. I mean, I get into it in the Redneck Manifesto in the 3rd chapter, basing a lot of it on Michael A. Hoffman II's They Were White and They Were Slaves. And one of my tasks is to resurrect that guy, because that guy did a lot of tremendous work in the 70s and 80s before there was an online dissident right or whatever. But the hillbillies were the original slaves of the colonies and indentured servants. They were called slaves. The term servant and slave were used interchangeably back then. But the merchants realized there were quite a few advantages to having black slaves. You could tell when they ran away. They were more amenable to a southern climate. You know, they didn't come from foggy Scotland or Ireland. But the white lower classes, the plebs, were driven off the flat, the lowland, swampy plantation economy, driven up into the hills, where there really wasn't much to be done. I mean, that's one of the alleged origins of cracker. They had to crack corn just to eke out some subsistence. Jimmy crack corn, and I don't care. There's another, they were the crackers of the whips. It's disputed. Hillbillies, obviously, are the ones that lived in the hills. One thing I think, and the mountain south is beautiful, and you've got some solid people up there in Tennessee and West Virginia. linguistically, I heard this. I have no idea whether it's true, but I've heard that that hillbilly accent is what the British sounded like 300 years ago, and that accent got preserved because London's such a cosmopolitan city. That accent has changed. But you get the you know, the guy saying you got a purty mouth. That's apparently what the British sounded like 300 years ago. So
there was this there was complaining. I don't know if you remember. There was this, was it in the 60s or 70s? I don't remember. There was a Robin Hood cartoon, you know, and they're all around from Nottingham, which I hear is the middle England or maybe towards the north. But they had them all speak in southern accents. You know, when you had the rooster singing about not a Nottingham, but they're not saying Nottingham the way the British would, but Nottingham. But someone responded that, you know, why are you complaining? The Southern American accent is the closest we have to the Nottingham accent of the 12th century. You know, it's because of the low rate of mutability of frontier dialects. Right. This is actually why. Even though we are the furthest apart in Slavic languages, Russian and Macedonian are similar because we have, because both languages have changed very little from Proto-Slavic because they're border dialects. You know,
now, as far as the origin of redneck goes, I think a term that predated that was red legs.
Ah.
And these were the pasty white, and I know that's, I guess, a racial slur, but the, you know, the Celts are pretty pale. That were, you know, sent, condemned by Cromwell to go work plantations in Barbados, the West Indies, and they got sunburned, and they were called red legs. And also the rednecks in America, if you work out, you know, on farming in the sun, your neck's going to get red. If you're from Nigeria, that's not going to happen. An alternate etymological derivation for redneck I heard was the Battle of Blair Mountain, I think it was the late 1800s, West Virginia miners wore red bandanas around their neck. No idea whether that's true or not. I think it's more likely the red leg, red neck, that it's white people sunburn. And we blush to who was it? Barbara Ehrenreich. She was some Jewish philosopher or activist. She said that, you know, white people are the only ones capable of blushing because, you know, we're the only guilty ones, I guess. But yeah, I think generally
it's very useful social technology. When people blush, you know they're flustered or lying, which fosters in-group cooperation, which is our superpower as a race, our real group superpower, along with Tumas.
Okay,
you know,
one thing when I was researching the Redneck book, I all these old Usenet use groups. There are people in Canada. They refer to the people in Saskatchewan and Alberta as rednecks. I think redneck is a little less geographically specific. Hillbilly, you have to come from the hills.
Okay. From my own studies, I'm going to recommend everyone read Albion's Seed, Four British Folkways in America. I don't know if you've read it, Jim, but if you haven't,
Aware of it. Michael A. Hoffman cited it, and they were white and they were slaves.
Right. And basically, the people who went on to become hillbillies they settled the southern mountain states and, you know, New Hampshire, the backwoods of Virginia, these places, and they are a specific Anglo-Scottish population. Right. They are the Anglo-Scottish borderers who lived on the borderlands between England and Scotland. Mm-hmm. And their accent is actually preserved in the mountains south. If, you know, people listening to the writer's block, you have probably also heard Millennial Woe speak. You'll notice that he has that hwa. He doesn't say what. He said hwat, hwa, hwat. And then you have Uncle Jared, hwat, right? It's the same sound. It's common to the Scottish accent. It's and to the American hillbilly and southern accents. So the Scotch-Irish borderers, because they also came from Ulster, they said
Ulster Scots, right?
Yeah.
These are
the hillbillies.
I haven't done DNA tests to verify. I remember reading that on the eve of the Civil War, 3/4 of Southern whites were Celtic and 3/4 of Northern whites were predominantly Anglo. No idea if that's true or not.
Yeah, I've characterized Anglo world politics long, long, long. And it's like It's basically a prolonged struggle between Celts and Danes, because you have basically the division is between West Country and Northumbria, right? Wessex and Northumbria, where you have the Cavaliers and Borderers versus the Danes of East Anglia and Midlands, right? Who settled, who went on to settle New England and Pennsylvania, respectively. And you get this map of England, where these people came from to America, and you put them together. You put together East Anglia and the Midlands, and you put on the other side Northumbria and Wessex. You see the divisions in the 8th and 9th centuries between Anglo-Saxon England, which was always more Celtic admixed, you know, because the Anglo-Saxons, they added a very thin layer of German on top, and Danish England, specifically that which has been conquered by the Danes, by the Vikings, and saw significant Danish settlement. And that's the political division of England today. That's the political division of the United States historically in the Civil War. And I suspect it is that if we had, you know, 100% white country, you would still have a tug of war, or 100% Anglo descended country, you would have this tug of war between Celts and Danes to this very day.
Absolutely. But, you know, phenotypical things make it much easier to tell who your competition
is. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
wrote a long time ago, if there were two, there were identical twins, if they were the only people left on Earth, they'd find a way to make it Crips and Bloods. People, I think, you know, conflict and tribalisms, people will split off and have schisms naturally, but the mix that they got going on here makes it that much easier. And like I said, because it's just visual at this point, that's one of the reasons they inaugurated black slavery. Plus, I think at least back then, the Celts, you know, the Irish slaves were a little more cantankerous and less docile.
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah, I mean, the easiest way that our enemies could turn ourselves against one another is to just go away. We're going to find all the differences we need, even within the white ethnostate.
Oh, absolutely.
But we have donations rolling in on eLive. We have, I think I mentioned Alaska Chaga, but just in case, he's donating a Ninja Genie. And thank you for that, kind sir. And White Rabbit Radio, the inimitable Tim Murdoch, is hosting this show on his DLive channel. And thank you for that, kind sir. I may be appearing on White Rabbit Radio later this month, but keep it under your hats, folks. Keep it under your hats. Cockney Nutjob. Cockney Nutjob just donated one diamond. That's amazing. Thank you for that, kind sir. 1001 Cuts donated one diamond. Well, thank you for that. Deconstruct has donated a diamond. And Donskoy 2 donated a Ninja Genie. Thanks again for that lovely vehicle. Oda Rocks has just followed. And we have Deconstruct donating one Ninja Genie, claiming that we are maladaptive due to the sizes of our heads. Well, okay, I guess, you know, thank you for the money, sir. You can insult me as much as you want because you keep throwing money at me. But we prefer entropy donations. But we prefer entropy donations, and you can give us those at entropy. Just if our mods would just drop it into the chat. Thank you. That would be great. And Gadius Maximus donating two lemons. Board Troll donating one lemon. And let me just refresh the entropy page. Have you, I think we can move on to the next article, unless Jim has any more thoughts on the rednecks versus hillbillies distinction.
It's just, I think, you know, it's more hillbilly. I mean, just, you know, it's cats and then Persian cats. Hillbillies are just a subsect of poor rural whites. But you have poor whites in urban areas too. I wrote an article for Countercurrents a few months back about Kensington in Philadelphia, which is brutal. It used to be all like in as late as the late 60s, it was like 97, 98% white. But nobody non-white dared go there because these were some hardcore knuckleheaded, you know, ex-Irish and ex-Scots. But that's not there anymore. Kensington's interracial and everyone's on heroin now. So you can't have her. I mean, amazing. Redneck hillbilly, the poor whites, it's not exclusively a rural phenomenon. Most of the stock that it was drawn from were, you know, people kidnapped off the streets of London in the 1700s. And, you know, in 1600s, but had been their ancestors had been driven off the farms in Scotland and England during the clearances.
I think that the people driven off during the clearances were herded into Glasgow and Edinburgh and Manchester, all of these industrial hearts of England, industrial cities of England, but. Yeah, there was a lot of, I guess, indentured slavery is more of a Wessex phenomenon, where the cavaliers, the English aristocracy, would just get these people in from the surrounding countryside, which for the most part meant the West Country of England, everything between London and Bristol, you could say, and just ship them over with them as basically slaves, indentured servants, or even as high-status servants, you know, butlers, to the New World. But it was voluntary in the sense that, you know, it was rape, but only at first is voluntary. You know, if that's a little.
There were organized Ryan of Nazareth. Spirit gangs. The term spirited away. There was a racket in kidnapping, and the term derives from kidnapping. Michael A. Hoffman got into that. I speculate, and hardly ever say anything definitive. I quote junior samples from Hee-Haw. I don't know anything. I suspect a lot of things because you look like less of an idiot if you don't make any definitive statements. But there was a pamphlet from 1670 which estimated that 10,000 impoverished white children had been kidnapped that year and sent to the New World. There was another pamphlet 10 years later which said 10,000 that year. If you extrapolate that on, you know, either end for 40 years, that's 400,000 unwillingly sent. That equals the amount of blacks that were brought here unwillingly.
Yeah. Sounds a little high, to be honest. Maybe it's an exaggeration.
I think it might be. I would reckon it matches or surpasses the total blacks because it was going on for much longer. They didn't really start bringing blacks in large numbers until the mid-1700s.
Mm. Well, you have a lot more hillbillies and rednecks in America than you do blacks. So if we extrapolate down from present numbers and adjust for the higher black fertility rate, we can arrive at maybe something. And of course, we'd have to account for the absorbing barriers of the Second World War, the First World War, and especially the Civil War. You know, that would.
Oh yeah.
Not a lot of black people died in that conflict, but a lot of hillbillies and rednecks died in that conflict. A lot of borderers were, you know, half and half with the Union Confederacy, but they did most of the bleeding and the dying for both sides, you could say.
And a lot of the vestiges of that, you know, up in the hills, they became the warring clans like the Hatfields and McCoys. And that war kept going on. Some of those schisms persisted for generations after the end of the Civil War.
Now, if I had a C note, I would give it to Mr. Goat to sing Renegade by Warren Zevon, which is a very painful song about the war.
Weird synchronicity there. I just have had a Warren Zevon renaissance over the last week or two, especially the Excitable Boy album. Did you see his appearance on David Letterman when he announced he had cancer?
I wasn't aware of the Zevon phenomenon in the year 2004 when that was a three when it happened.
Three, I think.
But I caught the Warren Zevon bug in distant 2007. And, you know, you listen to the man and not a single song misses. Not all of them hit, but not a single one misses. Not a single album missed. That's quite an achievement. And some of them hit very hard. Even today, even after how many 14 years of listening to him, at least once a week, I play a Zevon song. Back in the day, I would play entire albums. Mm-hmm. You know, he would be my constant companion. It's amazing.
Zivan's not a real surname. Do you know what his dad's surname was?
Yeah, Zhivotovsky, I believe, or Zhivanovsky.
He was a henchman of Mickey Cohen.
A Russian Jew.
Yeah,
mob boss. One of these people.
Yeah.
He has a song about his upbringing, about how basically his father appeared in this small Mormon town, scooped up his mother, sold her stories of fortune and fame, and how they're going to be living the high life. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was they ended up with very little money in Los Angeles. His father was smuggling asbestos, and Warren Zevon, he was playing among the asbestos, you know, up there in the attic. And 50 years later, it wasn't the drugs that did him in. It wasn't the gun-toting rampages. It wasn't the drugs. It wasn't the ex-wife. It wasn't Norman Mailer. It was the asbestos. He's died of mesothelioma, which is a cancer. Right. Of the it's not quite of the lung, it's the off the envelope of the lung, mm-hmm. which is caused by asbestos. Tragic story.
That's, I think Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner is a karaoke song I'd love to tackle.
Yeah, well, if I had a C note, well, hell, if I had any money to give, I would give it to Mr. Goat to perform that. Perform Renegade. You know what, Mr. Goat? I'm just going to indenture myself and give you everything I ever earned so you can cover the entire catalog. Zivan Avra. Okay. Right. We have donations. We have Alyaska Chaga with another Ninja Gini. Thank you for that, sir. I'm most grateful, and I'm enjoying your products immensely. Old Man Yinzer donating 5 ice creams. Well, thank you for that, sir. And Deconstruct donating a Ninja Gini. Yet England's school enrollments are now majority non-indigenous, i.e. offsprings of Asians and Africans. Well, you had to remind us, and we were having such a great time.
Yeah.
My Trail of Disgrace just donated 2 lemons. Well, thank you for that. And those would be the DLive donations. We have donations also on Entropy. We have a donation for $10 from Scott, the same leftist media that calls Christopher. I think this may be from last stream. So let's move on to the next one. Scott for $20. Jim, suppose you have 2 populations. In one population, most of the boys are socialized by women. Example, they're single moms and public school teachers. In other populations, most of the boys are socialized by their fathers and by women. Wouldn't you expect the men in these populations to turn out differently?
Yeah, absolutely. That's inarguable, of course. Mm. But I think, you know, it depends on the quality of the fathers and mothers, too. I mean, I was mostly raised by my mom because my dad worked himself to death, 80 hours a week. I mean, he died when I was 19. He died at 59 of colon cancer, but he was a plumber, a freelance plumber, 40 hours a week, and worked at an oil refinery, Gulf Oil in Southwest Philadelphia, the other 40 hours a week. So I didn't get to see him much at all. But sure.
That is unfortunate.
Yeah. And I mean, yes. I mean, men being raised by women are going to be maladjusted in every possible way. And it depends on the degree of adjustment of the woman, I guess, too. But, American, like the Guess Who sang about the American woman, they are just absolutely unbearable at this point. I mean, my wife is, she was raised, born and raised in New Orleans, but in a Spanish-speaking household. She's gorgeous and is not a cunt. And I suspect maybe she's inherently good. I think the not being raised in an American environment, somehow she sidestepped the, you know, cunt school training. She's not vindictive. She doesn't, you know, create problems out of nowhere, shit the bed, as it were. Doesn't bitch, nag, any of it. It's fantastic.
Now, well, it seems like, as we see here in Macedonia, your axe has fallen into the honeypot, Mr. Yeah. Goad. Yeah. And that's that. I'm happy for you. I'm genuinely happy for you.
Took long.
And we have a clarification of the earlier question from Scott for $10. In case you were wondering, the two populations are millennials and boomers. Millennials grew up in the 80s and 90s when divorce was common. They were socialized by women, and so, as you would expect, developed feminized attitudes. There is a real difference in development between these populations. I think this is non-controversial. I would add that there is probably genetic difference between millennials and boomers, and I would invite you all to look into the work of Dr. Edward Dutton and Michael Woodley of Menya with regard to spiteful mutants. And a mutation is, of course, likelier to occur the more advanced the age of the father. So basically, every year of a father's life after 35 adds geometrically, you know what geometric progressions are, we're all very good at maths here, geometrically adds to the probability of de novo mutations at the moment of conception. And of course, this is adding to existing mutations in the genome, which accelerate as evolutionary pressures decrease on a population as civilizational comfort arises. So it's not just a question of nurture, it's a question of genetics. The West may be losing its ability to, even when assuming hypothetically optimal nurture, produce quality men, because the genetic quality is not there. And we might have to go through a population bottleneck to recapture our vigor, but that's not something we should consider at this. I mean, we should definitely consider it, but not today. For today, we are here with Mr. Go to be positive, have fun, and comment, lament the decline of our civilization.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. Dr. Jim is one of the most positive people I know.
He's the sweetest man alive.
Yeah. He's exactly 16 times more positive than I am. So
it can be measured. As I'm known among friends, the iron marshmallow. The iron is
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. The iron. That's very unprofessional of me, just laughing out loud at my guest like that. Now, remember, Jim, I'm laughing at you, not with you.
That's I'm well aware.
Right. We have more clarifications, but Scott clarifies for $3 that the question for about Cantwell was intended for this stream. Okay, let's read it out. The same leftist media that calls Christopher Cantwell the crying Nazis has said that men who cry are brave for showing vulnerability. Shouldn't the media applaud Cantwell for his emotion of vulnerability while condemning his racism? Why isn't Cantwell the emotionally vulnerable Nazi?
Jim, you got anything? I don't know if he was being vulnerable, if that was just meth or something, you know. It depends on what you're crying about. That your Transformers toy didn't arrive on time from Amazon, that's one thing, but you know, not being loved, or you know, your child having some incurable illness, I think it takes a level of bravery. I think that's one of the reasons, besides the fact that they have to spend their lives around women, I think that's one of the reasons men die earlier, is they have to repress and bottle up a lot of stuff. I know that's not a conservative opinion, but I think that's true. And it eats at you. I mean, as much as you may want to just shove it down, I think it comes out in cancer and heart disease and everything else. If you're not honest with yourself and just kind of eat your emotions, I don't think that's healthy. And I think there's something manly about just being honest about your emotions, you know, but as long as it's not just weepy and tedious and annoying and self-pitying and all those unattractive traits, there is something, you know, if you can cry over something really profoundly tragic, I would count that as a virtue.
Yeah, I will add that basically we are, if repressing your emotions is a sin, we are sinning in the opposite direction as a civilization. We are living in the age of emotional incontinence.
Yeah.
And it's not even a metaphor. People are just bodily fluids are vacating the body at very, very, very inopportune moments. It's very inelegant. Now, it used to be that a man was allowed one manly tear per very tragic occasion. Now we're all expected to blubber, you know, at these occasions. And it's not, I don't like blubbering. I have blubbered in the past. I have weeped uncontrollably, but I've always taken care that it's not done you know, in public. It's not something a man should do. We should also not be, we should maybe learn, relearn anger, but not be very liberal with expressing it. If you feel angry, self-control is always better than expressing it. Save it for the ring, save it for, you know, we are writers, save it for the page. Just, I've been writing angry, and it's a great feeling. It's better than writing drunk.
Absolutely. I don't even think I ever wrote drunk since I quit so young. But I mean, my best stuff is where I can't sleep and I'm furious about something easily.
Right.
But I mean, there are people who don't express emotions at all, but are non-functional and just play video games all day. I'm not sure they're inversely correlated to an absolute degree.
That's good to know. I think that I wrote my best work on economics while stinking drunk on very sweet cocktails. But it's strange. You know, I'm usually the hoity-toity stories guy at Countercurrents, but this one I can barely see. I'm writing about economics. Tells you something about the discipline. We have $3 American from Redline, and he says, "Hail Appalachia." Well, I can agree with that. Hail Appalachia. We have $50 American from Aaron. Well, thank you for that, kind sir. That is a big donation. And he asks, Jim, your thoughts on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial?
For the worst week yet, which is coming out tomorrow, and you're probably mostly all aware of the histories of the three victims. I tend to fill in the gaps. I mean, I think I don't think most writers or propagandists outright lie as much as they lie by omission, or, you know, they might not even be aware of the details that they leave out. But that Jacob Rosenbaum was one hell of a piece of work. He was charged with anally and orally violating 5 boys aged 9 to 11. And even when he was in prison for 10 years, he was written up 40 times for infractions, like assaulting. And the thing, too, is there's video. I couldn't find him actually saying, "Shoot me, nigga." He said it repeatedly. And there's this like 58-second clip. It takes the joy out of it. He says, "Shoot me, nigga," like 40 times in 58 seconds. But it's just "shoot me." And then the nigga's bleeped out. It's like, I'd like at least to hear him say that. But I'm also speculating in the worst week yet. What is the term for a Jewish guy who acts black? Is it a jigger? Is it a Hebrew? Like, what is the Wigger, if you don't consider them white, then we need another portmanteau. But Kyle Rittenhouse,
let's call it Maskoff Judaism for now, huh? They're no longer pretending to be fellow whites. How do you, hey, what's up, fellow niggers?
Right. Well, they're gonna, that's the thing, though, they're gonna be seen as white anyway. But I mean, as far as I know,
I'm sorry, Jim,
I don't see how they can make
I'm sorry, Dinica's ghost in the chat says 50 shekels.
It seems like they have an open and shut case for self-defense, but they might, I might suspect they're going to get it on a technicality. I don't think he lawfully purchased that gun. I think they're going to get him on something like that. I could be wrong, but they're going to try. They're going to have to sacrifice him in some way, or there'll be more riots and more people getting their biceps blasted off in Kenosha.
That's sad. I heard it through the grapevine. Now, it may be wrong, but apparently George Floyd's nephew is calling on blacks to dox and intimidate the jurors. So it might not even be on a technicality. It might be that the jury convicts in self-defense. And that's a scary thought, because this is an open and shut case of self-defense. State lines. Yeah, it wasn't his gun, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was coloring in between the lines. He was skirting the lines, but no, never crossed them, really. But this is part of the humiliation ritual. You know, they locked up Chauvin and threw away the key because he was a cop enforcing the law. And this is, again, another humiliation of American whites. They're going to throw the book at this kid, not because he's guilty, but because, you know, if they don't do it, Blacks are going to intimidate and attack the jurors and their families, or they're just going to riot and attack white people in general. It's going to be like that case in Oregon where the guy defended himself and his girlfriend from a Negro assaulting them. And just like the guy who's asking, you know, if your boyfriend is white, you're single to me, fuck Timmy.
Timmy, right? What the fuck Timmy going to do? Right.
Timmy, you know, it's just hits so bad because you think about it. Yeah, Timothy, Timmy, they are white names. This is a white name, you know? And this is what Timmy's going to do. He's going to shoot you in the chest.
I mean, but I lived through the LA riots.
This means that basically it's legal for blacks to rape white women, and it's illegal for white men to protect white women from rape.
I think the Karen meme has a lot to do with that. It's to stigmatize actually calling the cops on black crime. And sure, I guess one in a thousand is just some neurotic school marm type who wants to get people in trouble, but if you know anything about black crime, I mean, I did a whole article praising their proficiency at crime, that no one's as good as they are. Well, maybe, you know, maybe not white collar crime, but they're even overrepresented in that.
I mean, I disagree with that. I voiced my disagreements at the time. See, it's like I'm not Italian, but I'm always obliged to speak in favor of Italian. I think that Italians, Jews, Armenians, a lot of these ethnicities, they are much better at crime, better at the goal of crime, which is to accumulate wealth and not get caught. Whereas blacks
are great at getting caught.
Right. Yeah, they're good at committing a lot of crime. They're not good at committing crime, qua crime.
Smart crime, right?
Right. It's really what are you in for the crime? I mean, like, let's go. I go out robbing. I'm in it to make money. But wouldn't it be better to just, you know, launder money with through real estate scams like the, you know, these groups I mentioned do, and I have a little bit of organized crime going, a little arms smuggling, a little white slavery, you know. That way everyone's happy. Or like the spirit gangs we mentioned from the 17th and 16th centuries. Now, that's an example of doing crime right. I'm going to strongly disagree with you, Jim. It's white people.
I already modified. They're great at getting caught at crime.
Right. And so that's, I think that's that question answered. And we have, unless you have anything to add, Jim.
No, but we may be slacking on getting to these other articles.
We definitely are, but there's just so many questions for Jim. He's a mighty popular fellow. I might have to get you on just to have discussion, but I cannot turn away all of these donations.
Right.
Mr. Reed Johnson is sending us $10. Question for Mr. Jim Goad. What inspired you to write, and when did you know your talent was for real? Something you could believe in enough to live on?
I'm not sure I was ever inspired. It was actually it was a default after. I mean, my dream was to be an actor, and I got accepted. And I auditioned as Alex from A Clockwork Orange, Alex DeLarge, at New York University. I got accepted to study theater with Stella Adler, who taught De Niro and Brando. And my plumber dad said, "No, that's a faggot's profession." So I drove a cab and went to journalism school with the less than lofty goal of writing record reviews. I wanted to be a rock critic.
But what I learned about put the kibosh on journalism school, or did he not know that there are even bigger faggots?
They didn't have to pay anything for that. I just took out loans and drove a cab and put myself through journalism school. That was the difference. They were going to have to fork over some money to send me to NYU. But once I learned what journalism was about, and I still respect the ideal where you treat it like a science, you don't read minds, you only report on what can be observed, you hang every fact on someone else so you don't look like a moron. I still admire all those. I mean, and you know, it's why I haven't done fiction. But then, like at this point, I realized, Jesus, you can make fiction up. That's a lot easier. And I think you can get away with a lot more in fiction. So I've written about 20 short stories, got about 10 more that I want to write, and that'll be my first fiction book, maybe in a year or two. But talent, I mean, thank you, but it's not, I don't look at it that way. And I mean, as humble bragging as it says, I'm not in it for praise. It's this autistic need to be understood. I mean, if someone likes it, that's great. The problem is sometimes people who like you too much make your life a living hell. So, and I've also learned over the people that I know, like, Nick Bugis is one of them. You never see him do an interview. He's not on social media. My friend Sean Tejeraji, who designs a lot of my books, logos, and stuff, runs screaming. He was like one of the most popular guys on Twitter. Rolling Stone magazine selected him as one of the 25 funniest people on Twitter. He runs just, you know, naked in the dark, away from any kind of attention. My wife, even people who went to high school with her, would not know how to find her online. People I admire most hate attention. For whatever like neglect I suffered, I needed attention for a while. I've learned to hate it because, I mean, and maybe I misunderstand myself, but it's very rare you're going to find someone, I'm not sure if this has been your experience, who understands what you're trying to say, at least as you understand it. It's very frustrating. You know, it always seems to be for the wrong reasons. So thanks for saying I'm talented, but I don't look at it that way. And it was a plan B after not being an actor. But I'm also glad that I didn't have to spend my life hanging around people who pretend they're other people for a living, because that would have been a different kind of hell.
That's very interesting. You know, if people asked me, how did you become, what inspired you to become a writer? It's like taking a shit, really. When you gotta go, you gotta go. You gotta get it out of your system. And since I'm getting it out of my system anyway, since, you know, it's gonna happen, why not make something of it?
It's always
the how best. I organize my thoughts, really.
I mean, have you ever written on assignment? That's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I have. I've actually written on, you know, you forget, I used to be an attorney for 6 years. I've written a lot on assignment. If writing is like taking a shit, this is like getting a high colonic, you know, writing on assignment, since we're sticking with the anal metaphors. Well, we are indeed slacking on the rest of the articles. No, we don't really have to cover them all, because, you know, even among the best, there is yet another selection filter. Now, if we are talking about, the anus, now let's move on to the penis. There is the Foreskin Defense League from Mr. Goad.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Goad, he wrote this article. It's about men who have lost their foreskins. Would you care to elucidate?
Well, you search the weekly news because you have to write about it. And I stumbled upon the, what are they called? Bloodstained Men. That's the name of the organization. They wear all white and sometimes white cowboy hats. But the uniform is they get red paint to stain their crotches. And they're on the street with placards, you know, stop cutting baby penis, circumcision is, you know, male rape, you know, it's not your mother's penis. And so, I mean, I'm a fan of that kind of ridiculous, ghastly street theater, just like the Black Israelites, like any of these people. But it's one of these things where it did hit home personally. I mean, I was born in 1961, and I think over 90% of American males were just routinely circumcised then. Maybe I have a distant sense memory of being traumatized in the, you know, in the nursery. Don't remember. So it's like, you know, not having a leg. I don't remember what it was like otherwise. But the night my son was born in July of 2008, and Gavin, and I know Gavin's an unpopular guy in these circles. Gavin, to his credit, has stood up for me and given me jobs for 20 years. Gavin's, he was born in England. He's not circumcised. But they just came in and asked us, do you want your son to be circumcised? I said, sure. Cause I mean, aesthetically, and also, I just heard horror tales about smegma and infections. So we said, yeah, but, they returned him to the, you know, where the hospital room the wife was in, screaming his little infant lungs out, and we immediately regretted it. And it's, you know, I write about double standards, which gets tedious, but it is genital mutilation and and non-consensual, at least when it's done that young. So I kind of, you know, it was him screaming that changed my mind on it, just like. I wrote an article, Why I'm Now Against Abortion. I mean, because when I was more deeply misanthropic, I was for mandatory abortion. Like, only select people to survive. But I was dating a girl. We had a deep, tumultuous thing, and she was disturbed in her way, and I'm obviously disturbed in my way. And we had this ritual. She would beg me to come inside her during sex, give me and make it explicit, give me a baby daddy. But immediately when it was done, she'd get dressed and go to Walgreens for a morning after pill.
That's evil.
And then she told me later that her mother... That's
just fucked up. I want it on the record that I consider that fucked up, repugnant behavior.
Yeah, I learned the roots of it probably were when her mother found out she was pregnant, she tried using some sort of morning after pill to abort her. So it's...
Ah.
Right. And in my own case, it's a story I tell. It's a unique story, but I think it tells a lot about my neurological development. As my older sibling, and they were all, 17, 13, and 12 years older than me. When my mom was pregnant, my dad punched her in the stomach trying to abort me. So it's like, well, I cared about that girl. I'm not so crazy that I don't care about my own survival. In those cases, I'm against abortion. That's way off topic of foreskins, but there's only so much you can talk about. You can't talk about 8 skins or 12 skins. You kind of stop at 4, and that's about it. But it is, I guess it's misandrist in some way, and it is a double standard. But I guess the guys who were snipped as adults say it's less, there's less sensitivity. And it's, but I was too young to know.
For my part, I am entire and shall remain so. You've heard about smegma. It's not no big deal. You retract the skin and it comes off with just water. No need to apply soap. And it doesn't even smell all that bad. It smells like penis. You know, it's sometimes when I use paper to wipe it out after peeing, pieces of paper get stuck in it. But that's about as bad as it gets. If you shower with any degree of regularity, it's no issue with hygiene. It's it may have made sense if you live in the desert and sand gets everywhere, including there. But no.
I think
there is a Edward Dutton show about wife circumcision is beneficial. But I'm like, okay, this is like, yeah, there are some benefits, but it's just not worth the thought of being a freak.
I think the humorous point I make in the article is that it can unite Islamophobes, anti-Semites, and men's rights people under the same skin tag. Yeah. There. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is, I agree with these people that, circumcision is mutilation. It's, you could even call, I'm just going to go ahead and call it evil. This is one of these examples where you agree with the message, but you wish to God it was a different messenger, or it was sent in a different way. I had the same feeling with, your fellow bald person, Stefan Molyneux. He's also very big against circumcision, but he's this one of these people who presents themselves in a false way. He's like a failed actor. He's very bad at it. And, when he starts, I'm sure he feels very passionately about it, but he acts like a person who acts being passionate about things. And there's an element of, I know you're trying to convey passion, but I'm just not buying it with him. And I'm thinking, if anyone else could just say the things this guy's saying in a normal voice without melodramatic, trying to be Shakespearean and all, I would 100% agree. I agree with it right now, but you're saying it in a very bad way. And these guys are even worse. These guys are like,
theatrical.
Why? We are men. We should not be presenting ourselves in this role as victims. When you take the passive role as a man, it's humiliating. It's emasculating. Well, you don't need extra emasculation. Your dick's already been mutilated.
Well, you don't go on the street advertising. The only thing that roused any kind of emotion was just hearing the pain of my son. That's what flipped me on that issue.
Right. It's very difficult to conceive of the kind of pain that would. There is evidence that infants are strongly traumatized by this kind of pain, and it inhibits their development later in life. But it is It's a vile practice. I don't know if it should be prohibited. I wouldn't give it a religious exemption, but it is what it is. It's part of the religious and practices of many faiths. Americans, it really is an American phenomenon. In Europe, it's only Jews and Muslims who get snipped. So that's something to think about. It was used back in the super happy fun times of the 1940s to identify Jews who were pretending to be fellow whites. So I guess it's useful in that way. But you know, the mid-century Germans would order men to strip down to their skivvies and show them whether they have the mark of the beast or not. And so I've been told. And that's I think we've exhausted the subject.
Yeah,
it's completely flaccid.
The subject of dicks. Stretched it out. Yeah,
just roll it back and pretend it like it never happened. I guess we can. I guess we can move on to something I genuinely enjoyed: America's Top Third World Mercenary. Now, in the day by Morris Van de Kamp, in the day of the 24-hour news cycle, this is like from a couple of weeks ago, and people have already forgotten it, but Colin Powell checked out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people made a big show of mourning him, of mourning Colin Powell. I wouldn't know why, but I like this characterization of him as America's greatest third world mercenary, and the American armed forces are becoming really a mercenary force, just a magnet for all sorts of non-whites who want to buy their way in. But Jim, what are your thoughts on the Army? I don't think I've ever heard you comment on the armed forces before.
I mean, the only wartime situation that I've seen America, legitimate thing that would require military over the past couple generations has been the invasion on the southern border. If we need a military force, it's for that. My father was in the Air Force during World War II. According to my mom, he came back just a violent drunk. My brother fought in Vietnam. Interesting story about him. He tried to go to the same university I wound up going to, Temple University in North Philadelphia, the war zone. But he went in 1967, and being an Irish Catholic kid from a brick row home in the burbs, he went on to an American campus in 1967. He's like, send me to Vietnam. This is another world here. He couldn't take the hippies or any of that. But he came back. I mean, he was so vital when I was a kid. He was my hero. He's 13 years older than me. He was a diver, hot rodder, greaser. Do you know who Todd Rundgren is, the musician?
Nope.
Maybe not. Okay. Todd Rundgren, he was pretty big in this. You might have heard the song Hello, It's Me, but it's not important. He was rather prominent in the 70s, 80s. He grew up like a quarter mile from us. My brother was a greaser. Todd Rundgren was a mod. And the greasers would call mods, like the people who had the Beatles haircuts, geeky boys. My brother used to beat up Todd Rundgren. He would prey upon the mods because it was considered un-American, British colonialism.
It was a British phenomenon, the mods, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And it was basically Britain selling American music back to gullible Americans. But he came back a shell of what he was before when he went to Vietnam. And he had problems with alcohol, and then he got into a car accident in the 80s, developed problems with pills. So personally, I don't see what we got out of World War II or the Vietnam War, and I would have liked to rather have a functional dad and brother. I mean, it's my objections aren't, pacifistic. It's just, what the hell did we get for that? What did we get for many of these excursions into the Middle East? It's one of those things, though, in economics, it's good to know your weaknesses or just what you might not innately be interested in. When I hear about the Middle East, I zone out. Same thing with the vaccine. I'm suspicious of vaccines. My son is autistic. He was perfectly normal until he got his vaccines at 8 months. I have not been vaccinated. That is the extent of my interest in the whole COVID vax thing. Otherwise, I blank it out. Same thing with the Middle Eastern wars. I don't see, and it's, we're obviously doing Israel's bidding. I don't see it as like defending what freedoms like, and I was, this is this still is fascinating to me. I was in Portland on 9/11, and it was Portland. But even your back then, your radical communist anarchist crust punk was fascinating. The month or two after 9/11, they were all waving flags and saying, let's go kill these ragheads. I was the only person I was aware of that was saying, well, what do you expect? What the hell were we doing in Kuwait? I think April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador, told Saddam Hussein, we had no interest in Kuwait. Go ahead, invade it. And then we go over there. And then the economic sanctions against Iraq, 1 million women and children die. How many bombs, how many people do you have to murder before there's some blowback? And I don't look at it as karmic or justice, just cause and effect. Like my whole, it's like, what the hell took so long? But beyond that, I mean, and Colin Powell in the article made a good case. He, you know, in the end, he was not an American patriot. He was black. He went for Obama. And I think that was the one objection that he touched on it. His wife didn't want him to run for president because they thought he'd get killed. But beyond, I mean, yeah, when the generals talk and Syria, something in me just, the off switch goes on. And it might be related to just having, family members who were damaged by American interventionism. Because we really haven't defended these shores. I mean, put them all on the southern border. That's it.
That is, I think, a very healthy instinct. Not my circus, not my monkeys, the Polish proverb. I love what Nick Fuentes has to say on the subject. Let the sand people fight over their sand. I'm making him sound like he's from the East Coast, but I can never get his voice and accent right. It's one of those elusive things, American Zoomer. Yeah, it's also Ann Coulter's take. We should take the troops which are on the Euphrates and put them on the Rio Grande. And never have truer words been spoken in the field of foreign relations. I agree with Anne. I quote tweeted her at one point on Twitter when she said something about Donald Trump. And this was when the Trump love was very egregious from the mainstream right. And Anne Coulter was pretty much the only sane person on the mainstream right. She said something about how he basically abused the trust of people who put him in office. I'm like, America doesn't deserve Ann Coulter. It just doesn't.
According to Gavin, because we all wrote for Tacky's, Ann told him that me and John Derbyshire were her favorite writers there. And then I called her bony in an article, and she didn't want to have anything to. I mean, where's the lie? But I guess women don't like being. I mean, she's a stick bug for Christ. She's a praying mantis. She's bony. I mean, bony was making her meatier than she is. But yeah, I've never met her. Never. I mean, she's best buds with David Cole, though. She props him up all the time. David Cole, that's a character. I knew him in the early 90s. We would go out to like a Golden Corral buffet in Irvine, California, have dinner and then go in the back room where like revisionist had rented the room, and like with a belly full of cheap buffet food, we listened to Bradley Smith or whatever talk about revisionism.
Yeah, I think she was attractive back in the Bush era, and where a lot of liberals wanted to hate fuck her. But age has sapped her beauty greatly. I don't know. It's something, I guess, when women grow older, if they put on a little weight, they can still pull off the matronly look. But if they are slender, if they remain slender, then they're no longer slender. Then they're just bony. They're just wrinkled skin trying to stretch itself over bones. And Anne was always, she has a man jaw. She's basically a man, psychologically speaking, obviously. But, you can see that in her physiognomy. As for David Cole, man, I'd love to have him on this show, but he seems to be allergic to everything countercurrents. And that is unfortunate.
I was told that by a different Anne, that he, even the mention of countercurrents.
Anne Sterzinger?
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
She knows him. She moved out there to be on a podcast with him. She's marooned in Palm Springs, but is getting married. She's been stranded there. She was proposed to in France in February of 2020, came back, and I think COVID hit while she was on the plane. But I guess they ease the travel restrictions. The fiance is coming to pick her up in January and is finally getting the hell out of the USA. But she was on a podcast with David. She's the one who got him onto tackies originally.
So that's good to know. Well, it is a shame. But David, if you're listening, you know, I'd be willing to interview you. We can have fun. I'm going to keep the mockery of the Jews and their false religion to a minimum. I'm even going to accept some of your wacky ideas about the Holocaust. But I would like to make it happen because you have something to teach us, I believe. So that's, I don't know if he's listening, but it's always worth a try. It's always worth a try. So Colin Powell, piece of shit. Long may he burn in hell. Press S to spit on grave. I think we are all agreed on that. I never really had an opinion on him, but there was, I think, a period in a very brief period, like maybe it was slightly before the Obama phenomenon, maybe right after it, when I read World War Z by Max Brooks, who is Mel Brooks' son, you know, where it's basically zombies have taken over the world. And the emergency president of America is Colin Powell. I guess he wanted a black Republican. And his vice president is, was it Howard Dean who screamed, wow, at the time? Yeah. The vice president is supposed to be Howard Dean. The president is supposed to be Colin Powell. And I'm thinking, okay, this is the kind of quote-unquote Republican that is liked by someone as dweeby and as New York Jew liberal as Max Brooks. So make of that what you will. That's my, you could say that's my assessment of the man, knowing as little as I know about him. But I found the article very informative, really about just the way this guy fell ass backwards into promotions and positions of prominence because he was black and because America just loves black commanders and heroes. You know, they're in every movie, every single time. I mean, Samuel Jackson is a millionaire because America likes blacks in leadership positions and can't get enough of them.
Endless Negro worship. It's been that way for at least 30 years. It was not always that way. I mean, in the 60s, Bill Cosby was the first black to have a starring role in a TV show, and it was a show called I Spy. And it was like the first black and white buddy show, Robert Culp. But I've always said this, but you know, I'm ancient enough. The two races in American media when I was a kid were cowboys and Indians. Blacks were almost like never mentioned. I knew there was a guy named James Brown, and I confused him with Jim Brown, the football running back, but you knew that they were in sports, but that's about all you saw them. They weren't ubiquitous in pop culture now. And that's one of the things in the worst week yet. Oh, my God. At Harvard, they're doing something called Macbeth in Stride. It's like an all-black, woke version of Macbeth. And it's all, yes, girl, you know, the queer us, the femme us. And it's a musical, and it's got rock music and fog and light show and everything. It's like it's Blackbeth. Like, everything is black now. Gone way, way overboard. And I compare it because I remember The Wiz came out in the mid-70s. It was like a black version of The Wizard of Oz. And at the time, we're like, oh, that's cute. Like, let them have their own Wizard of Oz. That's, as long as I don't have to go see it and like not be able to hear because they're screaming at the, you know, get stabbed or whatever. But they've gone way, way overboard. Everything's black. Yeah. Painted black, indeed.
I wrote a Soul Plane review, right? The review of Soul Plane, specifically because somebody commented in the comments that it's amazing that someone who hasn't ever been to America can write this. And I'm like, no. I'm the only person possibly who could write this. Not maybe me specifically, right. But you need to have a sort of distance so you can appreciate. See, that's the thing. I actually like American black culture because I don't really have to live around blacks. Right. You know, I don't have to put up with their effluvia of negativity and criminality and whatever the hell they do with their lives. If I can just watch them from a distance, I notice that these are basically, you know, not creatures like you and me, but they are very entertaining, especially when they think white people are not watching, right. Like in Soul Plane, like in Don't Be a Menace to South Central, where you're drinking your juice in it, or the thing where they do from Matt TV, which is Black Lord of the Rings, you know, the Lords of the Bling. It's one of these things.
Or have you ever seen Rudy Ray Moore movies or Dolomite, The Human Tornado, P.D. Wheatstraw? He was
seen Meteor Man.
Probably not, but he was like...
Does that count, Meteor Man?
I'm not familiar with that one.
I think it's just blacks being blacks, but one of them is a superhero.
He used to do these pornographic party records in the 60s, and it's just blacks in their own element being black. And it's, you know, from a distance, it's highly enjoyable. Or, you know, Red Fox comedy albums. Yeah, I only, when I first started listening to those, realized how sanitized he was when they put him on TV. Because he was a filthy comedian, but like so much funnier just being black and not under the tutelage of Norman Lear, who's 99 and still hasn't died. Norman Lear probably had more effect, and like, I guess in these circles, more negative effect on American culture in the 70s than anyone. He did All in the Family with the despicable racist patriarch and the Jeffersons and Good Times and Sanford and Son with Red Fox, but that was a severely sanitized Red Fox. I mean, blacks just being black when viewed from a distance are like you said, highly entertaining, very enjoyable to behold them just unfiltered, you know, with their, their bones in their noses and everything else. But Rudy Ray Moore, he was a great example of that. Blowfly is another one. He was a pornographic disco guy. Leroy and Skillet, LaWanda Page.
Or just pornographic disco.
Yeah. Blowfly. Yeah. Clarence Reed.
He did a lot of song
parodies. The first song he ever recorded was in the late 60s. It was a parody of Sitting on the Dock of the Bay called Shitting on the Dock of the Bay. But he would do the ABCs of Pussy, and it was just a disco beat and different letter free. Yeah, stuff like that. But it's blacks without white people getting in the way, just blacking it up.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm still trying to process the notion of pornographic disco. I guess it was just the 70s. I'm thankful I wasn't around for that.
You want a movie that encapsulates the desperate, hedonistic nihilism of the 70s, Looking for Mr. Goodbar with Diane Keaton. Oh, my God. I think James Brooks was the director. He's the same one who directed In Cold Blood, which is maybe the best true crime movie ever done from the 60s. But it was based on a big Judith Rosner, apparently some Jewish novelist, wrote about it. And it's this Catholic girl she had some kind of body deformity. Her bones were growing wrong. So she was in a cast throughout much of her youth. Repressed Catholic, you know, cruel dad. She becomes a school teacher. Some male school teacher turns her out. But then she just goes looking for cheap, casual sex in bars at night. And winds up on New Year's Eve. She meets Tom Berenger, rugged guy, but he just like he had an argument with his gay boyfriend. He goes with her, can't get it up. She mocks him. He stabs her to death. And probably the grimmest scene in a major Hollywood. That's how the movie ends. But I was around. I was young enough to old enough to kind of get a sense of it was just hedonism, but like achingly empty in the mid to late 70s. That movie does it justice.
Yeah,
you get a little bit of a Saturday Night Fever, but Looking for Mr. Goodbar definitely conveys it.
The way you're describing me, this is like drinking after beer number 12. You know you're not going to have a good next couple of days, but you just can't stop yourself because that would mean the evening is over. And if the evening is over, then well, you just wasted your evening.
But disco was sort of a reaction against hippies. Disco, I think, paved the way for the 80s. It was some kind of bridge, but it was the 80s to me were the plastic 50s, but it was all the drug, like more of the drugs and more of the sex and like worse drugs too, like angel dust and, you know, cocaine. Yeah, PCP is what, you know, was called angel dust in the 70s.
Right.
Quaaludes, which I can't say a bad thing about. That's the most enjoyable pill of all time. So good that they discontinued it because people liked it too much. But it was, people were just unhappy and just running. But that the, movie...
That would be the 80s, right?
Late 70s did it better. At least there was this pretense of going back to something wholesome in the 80s.
I think we're still living in the shadow of the 80s, if I'm being honest, especially on the political right. The political right just cannot come to terms with the fact that the 80s are over, that Reagan is dead, that basically Wall Street was a big fat lie and that the brokers are not on our side. There is a segment of the, even the dissident right, there is a segment which wants to go back to the 80s. You know, I, the Straussian segment, the free market guys, the whatever, they want to be back to that. They want to be Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. They want to be, you know, the psycho guy in American Psycho. I don't know what the hell they want to be, but we got to get over the fucking 80s, people. They want to be Rambo in Rambo 2. Rambo 1 is just hippie bullshit to them. But Rambo 2, that's the real Rambo, right?
See, I never took to the Rambo movies. Being from Philly, there's something about the Rocky movies, because that's every other guy I went to high school with. I could watch the Rocky movies end to end, like, forever and never stop laughing. Especially Rocky V, where Sylvester Stallone feigns having brain damage from the Russian in Rocky IV. Sylvester Stallone trying to sound dumber than he naturally sounds. Highly enjoyable. But just, I mean, I remember... Me and my friends, we saw Rocky III. We went out trying to beat people up. You know, we were roused to fighting. And that's the only sport I care about is boxing. And I watched the Super Middleweight Championship last night. Caleb Plant, some cracker from Nashville, versus Canelo Alvarez, who's, I guess, you know, culturally Mexican. He grew up in Guadalajara. Phenotypically, that guy's a ginger. He's freckly and red hair and very light-skinned. It's such a weird...
Latin America is far more diverse than you think. I mean, yeah. In the white people. You know, the founder of Chile, the George Washington of Chile, his name is Bernardo O'Higgins. That's an Irish man.
I've heard that Argentina is one of the most Caucasian countries on the planet. Hmm. But it was, I mean, as someone who like came of age in the 80s when there were no white boxers, it was a joke. I mean, Rocky was a white fantasy. The two, I wrote about that in Worst Week Yet. The two heavyweight champs are both white and Irish. I mean, there are no great American boxers anymore, I guess, except for lightweights. And none of those are white. They're black and Hispanic guys. But it was, you know, especially when I was a liberal in the 80s, you get these counterintuitive instincts. And I was going to write about this even back when I was reading Malcolm X and listening to Public Enemy. I'd see the white guy get a basket. There'd be some instinct like, yes. But Jared Taylor wrote about it. He wrote about like the late 50s, early 60s when Ingemar Johansson fought Floyd Patterson. He was the champ for a while. He was Swedish, but losing to Floyd Patterson, who was black, and just feeling like a sense of loss. And it's like, yeah, those instincts are there no matter how you try to like guilt trip your way out of it or brainwash your way out of it. Those you can't get rid of. So it was good seeing two white boys fight for the undisputed. Because Canelo is, I mean, there. I think the Irish army spent some time in Mexico. He's, you know, the rest of his family members are swarthy, but this was some kind of like gene expression. He would look like the Lucky Charms leprechaun. He definitely looks like entirely Celtic. And it's considered the best boxer in the world, pound for pound.
That is interesting to know. I don't know. I first saw Rocky IV, like, because I was born in the 90s and I'm a young fellow, and all of these movies were made before I was even born. The first Rocky I saw was Rocky IV, and I remember instinctively supporting Ivan Drago. No,
right.
Didn't understand nothing. It was just pure in-group preference because he looks more like me than does Sylvester Stallone. No offense to Italians. I'm just, you know, Nordic looking.
I offend Italians all the time. Yeah. They were on TV when I was a kid, it was Cowboys and Indians. But in my neighborhood, the two races were Irish and Italians.
Right. And the Italians were, of course, the Indians. They were the savages who would, or no, actually, the Irish are more savage than Italians. Well, anyways, I think that's fascinating. I did not know that about you not liking Rambo. Personally,
not disliking, I just could never. There's something about Rocky he's almost the perfect filmmaker because it's almost pure retarded formula, like no frills. It's the, I mean, he's it's like pro wrestling. He's almost down, but then there's that, you know, one of his best movies is Over the Top, where it's instead of boxing, it's arm wrestling. He's on, and then he just, you know, music comes in and he wins. It's like a computer could write his movies. They're almost, for retarded moviegoers, he's the perfect filmmaker.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I never really got that appeal of progress, but I guess that you want that formula somehow. When you just want someone to put you through the motions of the story you basically already know, I guess after a long day, that's something the human brain needs.
In the late 60s and early 70s, and I mean, those are some of my favorite American films, like A Clockwork Orange, Deliverance, Last Picture Show, Bonnie and Clyde. But that's the first time Hollywood, a lot of times the good guys didn't win. Then along comes this mentally challenged ex-porn star who like somehow gets his film produced and it's formed, the good guy wins.
I don't even think he's quarter Jewish.
What's that?
He's a quarter Jewish.
Oh, Stallone is?
Yeah.
I can see that. He doesn't seem intelligent enough, but okay. I can accept that.
Well, they're not an intelligence race. I mean, the whole 115 IQ thing is bupkis. They are very well networked, though.
Networked, okay, yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, there's some genius there. I mean, at least from observation.
There's a lot of nepotism, and there is some low cunning, but yeah.
I mean, that's a whole different show, but it was the first, I mean, I don't even think he won in Rocky One, but it was such a dumb movie, but it beat out like Network, which was a far superior movie. And there were good movies around that time, like Taxi Driver, but there's no happy ending to Taxi Driver either, really. I mean, good kind of wins, but then, you know, Iris is destroyed. Travis' life is destroyed.
I don't know what was the good ending of Taxi Driver. I mean, what are you going to, you're going to self destroy to rescue this whore?
Well, she's I guess is rehabilitated, and the pimp gets killed. So yeah, but I mean, Rocky was just the good guy, the dumb Italian who worked in the, you know, fish market of South Philly, you know, comes out on top. And then,
I guess the arrogant
black boxer. Cause I mean, that was what's Muhammad Ali, people like Muhammad Ali and Richard Pryor, what they did to the American psyche back then, they were celebrated for taunting white people. And I mean, when Ali came along, and I got this wrong, somebody corrected me and I went behind the server and corrected it. I thought Marciano was the last white undisputed heavyweight champion, but it was Ingemar Johansson, like 59-60. But the time Rocky came along, that was, I think, 75-76. You had no white champions for, like, you know, three quarters of a generation. And I think there are those instincts. And I mean, Ali made it clear. And that's something I write about in Tomorrow's Worst Week Yet, too. There's some Chechenian Muslim MMA guy who was challenging a white American guy.
I forget what his name is, but I know that guy. But Chechenians look white to me, if I'm being honest.
This guy, I say he looks like a Wyatt Mann caricature of a goat-fucking Muslim. He's just got the giant nose. He's got the Islamic beard and everything. But he's like, come on, white boy, I'm coming for you too. And that's something that still goes on. Devin Haney, look up Devin, Haney. There's one picture where it's just his nostrils. You could put quarters comfortably inside his nostrils. But he said like a year ago, ain't no white boy going to beat me, no white boy. And it's like open racial taunting. In MMA, about 8 years ago, there was Cain Velasquez. He had a giant brown pride tattoo. Somebody asked Dana White, the white owner of UFC, well, you know, some white fighters are complaining. He's like, yeah, but, and they always do this trick. Well, you know, when I'm from Boston and, you people had Italian pride, Irish pride, but any one of these white pride guys, that's just some hillbilly bumpkin from the backwoods, and get out of here. Cain Velasquez is Mexican. That's what it's like. Okay, but so just
I remember guy. I remember seeing him defeat Junior Dos Santos, and the announcer guy was creaming himself about how it's an American winning the title, and I'm like, well,
right.
First of all, Junior Dos Santos looks more American than Cain Velasquez, because I think Junior Dos Santos is 100% white or whatever, maybe a little mixed, but he looks whiter, more American, and that's what really American, you know.
Right, and I think Cain Velasquez like, dethroned.
This was I don't know, back then. I wasn't even red pilled, but it's just like, wait, what this guy? Who this is an American guy? No, he doesn't look American.
Well, the trick that Dana White does, and this is something that E. Michael Jones does too, liar. When he had that debate with Jared Taylor, he said, I'm from Philadelphia, and it was never white against black. It was Italian versus Irish versus German. It's like, no, it wasn't. It was never that way. But this is what Dana White did too. It's like, you can be Irish, but you never hear them say, well, you can be Nigerian, you can be Kenyan, but not black. You know, you can be Honduran, you can be Dominican, but not brown. They never say that. He played his hand too. He said some redneck bumpkin hillbilly from the remote outer country. It's like, okay, so you can be a redneck, but you can't be a coon or a wetback. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're such an obvious hole in what they're saying. It's the kind of thing. That's why I've chose to write, is because people who are full of shit or just logically inconsistent used to drive me more crazy than they do. But I realized it's futile because you're not going to change them. That's just the way they're.
Well, you're not going to change them, but you're going to intercept their lies. You know, I think I have evolved a lot in the time that I've been a dissident writer. And at first I thought you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But I realize now that the best thing the thing we are best at as dissidents is just shooting down lies. We are very good at shining the light of truth against lies, and we are damaging the elite narratives. We're damaging the controlled opposition narratives. And that is why they hate us. And that is why we're doing this thing on DLive and Odyssey instead of YouTube. This is why Countercurrents has been deplatformed from every payment processor except Entropy. And this reminds me, we gotta check Entropy. Are there any new donations? We have... 50 American dollars from Cozy James. He says, love your show. Well, thank you, Cozy James. I love your donation, and I love you too, to the exact amount of $50. And $50 from Dinica's Ghost. He just says 14. Well, if someone could please complete that conceptual hole, that would be nice. That would be greatly appreciated. And I agree with this thing you say. It's like, it really rubbed me as dishonest when you pointed it out. But if I hadn't known that, if you hadn't pointed it out about Philadelphia in the 70s and 80s, he would have been just the only source on that question. Yeah,
he's about 15 years older than me. He might have grown up in a time when there was such intense segregation that you never saw black people. Mm-hmm. And like I said, in my neighborhood, there were no blacks, I mean, for 10 miles. But so the only two races were Irish and Italian. But it's a trick. It's like, if you're allowed to be brown and black, you should be allowed to be white. Or if you can't criticize coons and wetbacks, you can't criticize rednecks. Either drives me nuts. But what I'm trying to say is, like, at what personal cost do you point out these lies? How much misery do you self-inflict by just staring at these idiots? I mean, maybe it's wisdom, maybe it's just defeatism, but after a while it's like, well, the world's gotten worse after pointing out these lies for 30 years. Maybe I should have become an accountant or a lawyer or a physician and I'd be happier. You know, it's at what personal cost? Because when I tell people, oh, I wish I hadn't, it's like, oh, you've changed my life. It's like, yeah, but I'm talking about me here. Like, it hasn't really made me intensely happy.
Well, as someone who tried doing the lawyer thing, it just didn't work out. At some point, they ask you to say more lies than your soul can handle. And I may have a very low threshold for lies, but every human being outside of the most reprehensible act has a lie threshold that they will not cross. And that's where they start thinking in the dissident direction. And like, I'm not making this up like I'm some great moral force. I'm probably mildly autistic, maybe closer to the schizophrenic side of the spectrum, because, you know, I have a little bit of the paranoia going on, which has kept me safe low these years. But it is something to consider that at some point they're just going to ask you to lie, to tell barefaced lies, and you're not going to do it.
I could see being liking law just in its pure form, and, you know, following the letter of the law, and I could see the legal profession being just as exasperating, if not more so, than being a writer.
At a very early point, I realized that basically it doesn't matter how much you know or how well you argue. You know, you are prepared for rhetoric to be more powerful than argumentation. You're right. Always prepared for that, because that's really the way it is. You're prepared for corruption. What you're not prepared for is the law being essentially theater, mm-hmm. and the decisions really being made behind closed doors by people way the fuck up over your head. And you're thinking, well, why am I trying to be professional and polished and all this when the decision's already made? And you just want me to act out a role which has no bearing on the outcome.
That's where my regrets are, is being too naive or too idealistic to not really apprehend the way things really work.
Mm. Yeah, that is the thing. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, so I just want to touch on something we touched on earlier. You called the 80s the plastic 50s. Now, you mentioned films of the 70s, and I love American films from the 70s. I mean, I'm a gigantic Hal Ashby fan, and you could probably say that pound for pound, he's my favorite director, Hal Ashby. I also like when these new Hollywood guys, you know, Scorsese and, what's his name, Peter Bogdanovich. And then you segue into the 80s, and I think the transition from Rambo, First Blood, to Rambo 2 really exemplifies it. You have these deep, nuanced character dramas, really, that Harold and Maude, for example, is just a weird, quirky movie, even by the standards of today. And then you move into the 80s, which is just, someone in the chat called it rocket launcher shit. And that's very interesting to note. Just you think about the 70s, beyond the hedonism, there is the question of, okay, what the fuck are we doing with ourselves? The cinema from this period is very dark.
Oh yeah.
And then you have the 80s, where it's just cheesy. It's just cheesy. Morality tales like Scarface are cheesy.
And the difference, I think, is in the 50s, it was probably the best time to be an American. America was on top of the world. The month I was born in 1961, the top five TV shows were all Westerns. The idea of expansion and conquering was still huge. I think the 80s were people got too freaked out. They did too much acid and angel dust in the 70s and wanted to retract, but it was too late. America had already started to decline. So they were kind of just LARPing at the 50s. And there was an inauthenticity to it. I mean, because Reagan, whatever, you know, however he made people feel good, which I still think is a president's main job, the debt increased, he gave amnesty to illegals, demographically, everything that Republicans were supposed to be against got worse. There were a couple minor, the tiny military victories then, which, because I remember Carter, and I always remember this was the year before my dad died of cancer. Jimmy Carter, there was the Iran hostage crisis, and they sent some helicopter in to rescue the hostages, and the helicopter got shot down or it crashed. And he was just, I mean, probably, you know, as far as raw brain power, one of the smartest presidents we've ever had, but not a good leader. And I remember the Pittsburgh Pirates won the World Series, and Jimmy Carter somehow wormed his way into their locker room while they're showering each other in champagne. and he's just grimacing and he's trying to talk to Willie Stargell or one of the baseball players. I remember my dad just being disgusted. America really got kicked in the nuts in the 70s because there was expansion, and then lost Vietnam, humiliated by OPEC. I remember gas lines and, you know, and stagflation where there was double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation. It was like the empire came screeching to a halt in the 70s. I think that's a fact. And just, you know, realizing we've been lied to about Vietnam and just the fact that, I mean, Korea was maybe a stalemate. Vietnam was an obvious loss. You know, and I think there was a Bill Murray, I think it was Stripes. He's like, okay, we're the best in the world. We're 11-1. And everyone knew what the one was. That was when America started losing and contract. Now everything, whereas it was expansion the year I was born, everything is retreat and apology and backtracking and revising, you know, shame. Those were none of the things. I've said it before, the modern patriots, I kind of have a pity for them. They remind me of the guys down here who reenact the Civil War and hoping that one day, you know, the South will rise again. I'd love to be wrong. I think it's way too late for what used to be, or the America that I you know, was born into is definitely dead.
Well, it's like Mr. Zevon says, some dreams refuse to die. Next time I'd rather break than bend. It's a very powerful, you know, it's one of those moments where it's okay for a man to shed a single solitary male tear. I think that is very profound. Of course, there's also Watergate. Now, we do understand that Nixon, he might have been the better choice, the best thing that the Republican Party ever blundered into. You know, intending to lose, they accidentally won with this guy and then just gave it away.
And I think he won 49 states, a landslide, destroyed McGovern. But then a year and a half later, it was the most hated man in America. And that was the thing, too. And I touched on that, and I forget what the article was.
Precisely. It was basically, there are opinions that out there that the president is more like a religious figure than a political figure in America.
I think it's almost like a monarch. Yeah, it's someone, it's symbolic. I think the Federal Reserve is the real government, finance is what runs things, but they couldn't run things if people were aware of that. But when Nixon resigned, that was another kick to the nuts of America. And the term, it was in the article I did about learned helplessness. It was called the 1,000-year whimper. The term apathy, like for the first time in my lifetime and maybe in American history, everyone felt lied to by their authority figures. So that was almost a death blow. The 80s were this, and just MAGA too, they were these desperate attempts to reconstruct or give chemo to something that had become terminal.
Yeah, we're not going to move. Well, you know, we're talking about America, but this is actually because America has American culture leaks all over the world. We are not going to move one iota into the future unless we shed the 80s, which are plastic 50s aesthetics. We're gonna have to move past this. You know, there's not going to be Gordon Gekko. There's the Gipper is dead and buried. He's decomposed by now, I think. You know, these things happen. You know, my childhood is also dead. The 90s are not coming back, no matter how many times I watch Digimon. It's my glory days are also over. I'm going to be 30 in less than a month, and I'm going to have to face life as an old man.
Condolences.
It's one of these things, you know. I mean, you're not just old enough to be my dad. You're the exact age as my dad. You're literally twice my age right now, and yet I am looking at the big 3-0 with absolute dread. And
I remember when I met my first wife, I was 24, she was 32, and I considered her middle-aged.
Right.
Even that term, oh God, I'm with a middle-aged woman. But no matter how like creaky the battleship gets, and I'm sure writers have written about this, there's this eternal sense of self. I'm still the same kid that I was. I mean, it's just the world has deteriorated as well as, you know, my body. that's about it. Yeah. But still, you're still the same age inside, unless you capitulate. I've still, with, you know, prison, terminal illnesses, brain tumors, I'm still spunky. Maybe that's the Celtic part. I don't know.
Yes. Well, the Fighting Irish, they will never go down. Oh, so I've been told.
They'd hardly ever win.
Yeah, well, that I think that adds to your mystique. You know, if you won, you would break this 5,000-year losing streak, and that's something. You know,
I mean, got people... a combination of Philadelphia plus Irish. That's almost fatal. That's you're going to be a fighting loser forever.
It is a I could just launch into a tirade about. Well, basically, we worship losers a lot here in Europe because we have very long histories with a whole lot of losing in there. And there's a different extreme, which I see in America, which is this cult of victory, which is the inability to realize that victory does not grant you legitimacy. Identity grants you legitimacy. That's the thing. But what wins is not always good, and you can survive defeat. It has been done. I know it feels like shit to be defeated. I've played sports as a kid. I still sometimes play sports. I play chess. I play all of these beautiful games. When you lose, it's not a good feeling, but you can survive it. You can survive anything. And with that, we've been going for 2 hours and 6 minutes now. That's 6 over our allotted 2. I'm going to have to let you go, Jim, and everyone else. This has been a very enjoyable 2 hours, Jim.
Letting you go is unacceptable, but go ahead.
Right.
Cut me loose.
Yeah, I'm going to. Thank you, sir. Well, I'm going to end the broadcast with the two of us still in studio. And I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank everyone who tuned in, everyone who kept the chat lively and kept me giggling throughout. I want to thank our heroic and indomitable moderators, Gadius Maximus and Bartleby, not only for your masterful policing of the chat, but also for that lovely donation. You will be getting your rendering of I've Always Been Crazy from Mr. Goad. He has given his word, Scout's Honor, it's Philadelphia Irish Honor, which is even stronger than Scout's Honor. And, of course, this has been the Writer's Block. I want to thank Jim again for a lovely 2 hours. And, I guess that's all I have to say. Bye-bye.
Keep those contributions, please. Keep this website alive, guys.
Yeah, we need to survive. And bye-bye.